What does democracy mean? Town meeting tonight.
No more appropriate place could be found for a discussion of the subject, what does democracy mean, than our own town hall in New York City, the home of America's town meeting of the air. Here, where public questions are discussed each week by eminent authorities, while a mighty radio network makes it possible for an entire nation and parts of both American continents to listen, here where free speech, frank and open debate are always in order, we meet tonight to try to come, if we can, to a clearer understanding of the meaning of democracy. Here on the platform, seated around a table, are five experts on the philosophy of government. In the center of the group is our moderator, the president of Town Hall, Mr. George V. Denny, Jr., and there is an audience of nearly 1,500 people who are eager to participate in this discussion. But first, let me present our moderator, the founder and director of America's Town Meeting of the Air, Mr. Denny.
Good evening, neighbors. I suppose there's no word more generally used today with such a variety of meanings as the word democracy. We all pay it profound lip service, but when asked to define it, we usually stumble badly. Now, just so that we may start from some accepted standard, I will read two dictionary definitions of democracy. The Funkenwagnall Standard Dictionary calls it government directly by the people collectively. Webster's New International Dictionary describes it as a form of government in which the supreme power is retained by the people and exercised either directly or indirectly through a system of representation and delegated authority periodically renewed as in a republic. Whether or not the speakers will accept these definitions remains to be seen, but your chairman notes in these definitions the absence of several accepted characteristics of democracy, such as majority rule, freedom of speech, protection of the rights of minorities, the right of private property, in short, all of our so-called civil liberties. Democracy is referred to as self-government. Can a modern state really accept this in its literal sense? In the early American town meetings, a majority of all citizens of a community used to meet together and determine where to build the new schoolhouse, how to run the new road, and what to do about Widow Jenkins' obstreperous cow. Is it possible to conceive of self-government today in those terms? What then does democracy mean under present conditions? Now, I'm sure we'll not be able to give the answer to this question satisfactorily for all this evening. But we may be able to find some common denominators and throw some light on what are usually called democratic principles. In introducing our speakers, I'm not going to refer them as representatives of any particular doctrine or ism. In my conversations with the speakers, I've been assured that each believes in democracy according to his own interpretation. But that we have representatives of widely varying points of view will be readily apparent in the opening statements of each speaker. We are to hear first from Salvador de Madariaga, distinguished Spanish statesman and internationalist who for many years represented his country on the Council of the League of Nations. Going round the table so that each may present his point of view briefly, we will hear next from Mr. Clarence Hathaway, member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party and editor of the Daily Worker. Next, we will hear from Mr. Isaac Don Levine, author and columnist. And then from Mr. Max Lerner, editor of The Nation. And last but not least, we'll hear from the lady in our midst, Dr. Ruth Alexander, political economist and lecturer of Chicago. We will confine our conversations to this group for the first half of the program and then let members of the audience ask questions of the speakers. Now, Mr. de Madariaga, you've been working for some time on the establishment of a world foundation, and you've written extensively on the subject we are discussing this evening from the world point of view. I wonder if we may hear from you first. Mr. de Madariaga.
I call republic a healthy and peaceful community that knows itself and governs itself accordingly. I call democracy a community, like all communities governed by a minority, but when this minority is under the effective control of the majority. A democracy may be healthy and peaceful, or it may not. It depends on the wisdom, the education, and the information of its majority. and on the quality of its leading minority. A community is a complex form of life. It has laws of its own. A majority may or may not fit in with these laws, just as a man may or may not live a life suitable to his health. The discovery of the natural laws of a republic can only be made by the methods of trial and error. Therefore, a democracy implies freedom of thought. No freedom of thought, no democracy. Or rather, for all in life is relative, the more freedom of thought, the more democracy. It follows that a true democracy implies government by common consent. A majority has no more a right to bully a minority than a minority a majority. Nevertheless, when it comes to immediate action, as distinct from discussion, the ruling of the majority must be respected and prevail, even if the minority think it wrong. Modern methods of mass suggestion and propaganda make universal suffrage dangerous. Leaders have a duty to differ publicly from the majority if they differ from the majority in private. Mass rule is not democracy. Majority rule must seek to organize itself so as to avoid mass rule. Amongst the instruments of mass rule, specialists must be mentioned: emotion and passion and red herrings, namely, subjects on which to obtain a blank check from the majority in order to deal at will with subjects on which a majority would have been impossible. Economic interests cut athwart public issues. They generally warp the citizens' judgment. Hence, economic votes should be taken on guild or corporative lines, while political votes must be taken on territorial lines. Ultimately, a community must be judged by the amount of violence it needs to subsist. The lesser the violence, the better the democracy.
Thank you, Mr. Dimitriaga. Now, Mr. Hathaway, if I remember our conversations previously, I'm afraid you won't agree entirely with Mr. Dimitriaga. Mr. Hathaway is a member of the Communist Party, the Central Committee of the Communist Party in this country, and is editor of the Daily Worker. We're very happy to have him on our program. Mr. Hathaway.
Today, there are many people who fly the flag of democracy, but like the pirates of old, are only attempting to put themselves in a position where they can best torpedo democracy. I advocate a democracy that will give to the people the opportunity to completely determine their life in the economic, social, and political sense. A democracy that will place control in the hands of a majority. A democracy that will give to the majority a full opportunity not only to preserve democratic institutions, but a democracy that will give to that majority the opportunity to carry through, in the fullest sense, those social changes that are necessary to meet the changing needs of the people as economic and social conditions change. In short, I am not an advocate of the kind of democracy as is represented by those Southern senators who, during recent weeks, have been filibustering the anti-lynching bill. I'm for a democracy that will give to the American people not only a full expression today, but that will give them the opportunity to bring about those changes that are necessary to solve the problems of crises, to solve all of the economic and social problems that they're confronted with. In brief, I'm for that kind of a democracy that will enable the American people to bring about the transformation from capitalism to socialism. I believe, moreover, that this majority rule must not only guarantee to the people the right of self-expression, but it must be a majority rule that gives to the people the power and the authority to destroy that anti-democratic minority that is out to destroy democracy, that's out to introduce fascism. In other words, I want a democracy that carries with it two things: the power to give to the people what they want, and at the same time, the power to prevent an anti-democratic minority from preventing the proper operation of a democracy. That's the position that we hold.
Thank you, Mr. Hathaway. I see we have these right and left views rather mixed at our table tonight. We'll go down to the left end of this table and hear a rightist view from Mr. Isaac Don Levine, well-known author and columnist, and we're very happy to welcome to the town hall platform. Mr. Levine.
I favor a great deal of Mr. Hathaway's democracy for Soviet Russia. What does democracy mean? Only they who do not live under democracy know and appreciate what it really means. Ask the refugees from Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, and fascist Italy, and they will tell you that democracy is the only known escape for the common man from darkness to civilization. Shakespeare long ago gave us the best definition of absolutism, which will help us rediscover the meaning of democracy. He said, a dog is obeyed in office. Where dog is, there is dictatorship. Where the underdog attains the status of a free and independent member of society, there is democracy. Absolutism is a system of government which keeps the people gagged and muzzled. Democracy is a system which enables the people to keep the government on a leash. For 5,000 years, humanity lived under one form or another of dogocracy and struggled to cast off its yoke. In the little more than a century that humanity has lived under democracy, it has created infinitely more wealth, multiplied the productive and cultural capacities of the world many more times than had been achieved under 50 centuries of dogocracy. In a bare five generations, democracy has raised the standard of living of hundreds of millions to unexampled heights by unleashing the individual, by emancipating man's creative faculties in every direction. Yet democracy is still in its infancy. It is still having growing pains, but who can challenge its record for gigantic progress? How does democracy do it? Because democracy is the guardian of the minority, and all progress stems from the minority. Democracy is not just another ism. It is the shelter, indeed the cradle of all isms. It digests what is healthy, throws off what is poisonous in the welter of ideas and movements which it breeds. At present, democracy is suffering from an acute attack of indigestion. Without the protection which democracy gives to the individual, to the minority, every social, political, economic, and scientific movement in modern civilization would have been impossible. For all these movements go back to individual minds, to liberated human spirits. What then does democracy mean? Democracy is a political system of self-government which pays the highest economic dividends to the largest number of people. With the coming of the machine age, itself a product of democracy, a great confusion was let loose in the world. People were taught that government is identical with social welfare, that government ownership is the same as people's ownership, that a parasitic dogocracy can become a substitute for democracy.
I'm sorry, Mr. Levine. We want to hear the rest of that when we get around with our 3 minutes. Thank you very much. Now let's hear from your neighbor there, Mr. Max Lerner, the editor of The Nation. Mr. Lerner.
We are living today on the thin edge of history, and that does an enormous amount to change our perspectives. But I feel a bit wary about a new and sudden love for democracy that I've noticed on the part of all shades of political opinion. We are a capitalist democracy, but I believe that three-quarters of the people who talk of democracy as the American middle way between two extremes use the term because it enables them to soft-pedal the fact that their primary purpose is to strengthen the capitalist structure. What they really mean is capitalist democracy, only they prefer to leave the adjective out. The others use the term because it enables them to soft-pedal the fact that their primary purpose is to displace capitalism. What they mean is socialist democracy. Only they, too, prefer to leave the adjective out. Democracy has thus become a much-wooed maiden who is simply swamped with suitors in America today. When I speak of democracy, I mean that it is a combination of four elements. First of all, democracy is majority rule, ballot box democracy, freedom to vote, freedom to organize parties, the democracy of representative government, in which the executive and legislature, as representatives of the people, shape policy. Second, democracy is civil liberties, freedom of expression of all kinds, a mechanism not only for guaranteeing minority rights, but also what we tend to forget, a mechanism for ensuring majority rule. This is important because there's a tendency noticeable recently to feel that civil liberties exist only for minority rights. The danger of abridging civil liberties comes from majorities, and that it is therefore necessary to retreat from the principle of majority rule. May I suggest that it was the minorities in the fascist countries that suppressed civil liberties, and only by suppressing them were they able to smash majority rule. I've spoken thus far of political procedures. I turn now to economic realities, the third element in democracy. Democracy must mean democracy in work life as well as in political life. It must mean democracy in corporate structures, democracy in trade unions, democracy on the job everywhere. It must mean what is even more important, freedom of opportunity, so that every child starting life will have at least a chance to show what is in him. With our concentration of economic power today, with the growth of our monopoly corporate structures, that chance has almost reached the vanishing point. I believe in difference as a native ability. I believe that the American dream was based on genuine freedom of opportunity, and that unless we can build up adequate social security and adequate control of our corporate power, we have no real base for our political democracy. It's like trying to wear a good-looking glove on a diseased hand. It's like having a handsome and formidable architectural facade when behind it the walls are loose and the plaster crumbling. My fourth point is that democracy...
I'm sorry, Mr. Lerner. We're going to have to take that after we get around. Thank you very much. Well, this discussion would certainly be incomplete if we didn't hear from a lady. We have with us tonight a well-known political economist and lecturer of Chicago, Dr. Ruth Alexander. Dr. Alexander.
I am a friend of the old-fashioned democracy of the liberal founding fathers. Its essence lies in the character of the people who compose the electorate, in a consistent understanding of freedom, and in a limited interpretation of equality. Traditional American democracy rests on intelligence and ethics in the people. Alert thinking is the dynamo of democracy, what makes the wheels go round. And personal morality is the price of private enterprise. The predicaments of democracy lie in its people, not in its principles. It stands or falls on the character of the electorate. Both as a form of government and as a way of living, our democracy holds a self-evident truth that freedom is the most universal and durable of all human desires. Today we are confronted with two opposing and inconsistent interpretations of freedom. One part of our electorate, such as big business, vigorously supports freedom of enterprise while frequently opposing freedom of speech and assembly. Another part, such as political and industrial agitators, ballyhoo civil liberties while seeking to destroy freedom of enterprise. Both use one freedom to advocate abolition of the other. Both willfully ignore the inseparable connection between freedom of enterprise and freedom of discussion. American democracy believes in separation of powers, not only within the state, but between economic and political spheres. Man's economic and political activities must be independent in order that he may be free to disagree in open discussion of public policy. For liberty of speech is inconceivable wherever the sovereign political power and the determination of price reside in the same body of men. If the individual depends on the state for his income, either directly or indirectly, his independence has vanished. Before each can be provided for by the state, each must put himself under the orders of the state. American democracy has at no time aimed to provide economic equality in the sense of equal reward for unequal contributions. Even approximate equality involves centralization of power as the means of reducing the spread occasioned by the natural inequalities in man's ability. We are committed to liberty, frankly acknowledging its implication of differences. In the light of modern European experiments, economic equality has proved itself incompatible not only with political freedom, but with political equality. Liberty has always been stimulated by oppression. Perhaps the threats of trends will force us to revalue freedom anew in the light of its previous benefits and its possible loss.
Thank you, Dr. Alexander. Well, now we're ready for the discussion. And Mr. Madariaga has handed me a note here that he wants to ask Mr. Hathaway a couple of questions. Mr. Madariaga?
Chairman, I find that most of what I've heard falls in quite with my opinions. But there are two points in Mr. Hathaway's speech which ask for some elucidations. He said that a democracy should offer an opportunity for the majority not merely to rule, but to destroy the anti-democratic minority. Now, I would put it in a different way. I would put it in this way, that the majority must be in a position to deal with its anti-democratic minority in a defensive way. If the majority feels that the minority means destruction of the majority, but that the majority should not destroy the minority, but try to enlighten it. And the second point is about opportunity for changes. No government that does not provide for changes is any government. Governing is precisely canalizing the changes. But does Mr. Hathaway mean that the opportunity to be offered the majority for operating changes must include the opportunity to effect these changes by violence or strictly only by agreement and discussion?
Mr. Hathaway.
To take the last question first, the question of the bringing about of social change. We have those in the United States at present who would make of democracy some rigid thing that would prevent the carrying through of such social legislation or such adjustments in the economy and social life of the country as are made necessary by changes. Fundamental changes in the country. They see democracy as something static, something to hold the people back, to prevent them from bringing about change. And I insist that a truly functioning democracy must serve the opposite purpose, to give to the people the opportunity to fully express their desire to adjust themselves to new problems as they arise. As to the method of such change, the communists are for a peaceful, democratic method of change, and on such occasions when other methods are resorted to, it's not the choosing of the communists, but it's the result of the efforts of a dominant minority to prevent the majority of the people from bringing about those changes that they want to make.
Thank let's stick to this question of majority rule and freedom of minorities all the way around the table. Mr. Levine, you had some comments to make about that.
I would prefer to finish what I had to say in the beginning.
All right, fire away.
And I cannot see any discussion starting unless I complete it.
Good. Go ahead.
I regard the greatest aberration of our times to be the belief that government ownership is identical with people's ownership. If not for this stupendous aberration, we could see democracy in its true light. We would then behold a system which has within the lifespan of some of our oldest citizens lifted 2/3 of the population from the depths in which all the common people were sunk since the beginning of history. Democracy has earned the right to say to the people, I have tamed absolutism. I have limited the evils of government. I have bridled aristocracy, plutocracy, and bureaucracy. I have checked militarism. I have given you more political power and civil liberties than you ever enjoyed. And I am ready, if you give me a chance, to lead you to an ever-increasing share in the wealth which you create, in the property which you produce, and to a society where capitalism will not be a state monopoly, nor a financial monopoly for the exploitation of the masses, but a system of production owned directly by the people as proprietors and managed for the welfare of all the people. In the light of this statement, perhaps we can have a discussion, Mr. Denny, on the relative merits of the changes which Mr. Hathaway must have had in mind when he favored democracy.
All right, Mr. Hathaway, it looks like Mr. Levine has thrown this challenge to you. I'm sorry, we pause for station identification.
What are the...
All right, back to town hall, continuing our discussion on the subject, what does democracy mean? Mr. Don Isaac Levine wants to raise a question and have Mr. Hathaway answer. Do you want to repeat it, Mr. Levine?
What are the social changes that Mr. Hathaway alluded to?
I believe that a truly functioning... I believe that a truly functioning democracy must not only be a political democracy that gives to the people the right to vote, to hold office, and so forth, but it must be that kind of democracy that will grow out of the social ownership of the means of production by the people. I believe that a true democracy can only exist when there has been eliminated those differences that arise from the big monopoly control of the natural resources, the basic industries of the country, as exists today here, and instead, the kind of democracy that will give to all of us an equal economic opportunity to advance ourselves, to train ourselves, and so forth, for a full participation in the social and political life of the country. I want socialism.
Mr. Demandariaga wants to comment.
But the point I make is this. Mr. Hathaway and his friends believe that. Other people believe the reverse. What I want to know is, what does Mr. Hathaway propose in order to change over from the state in which Many people believe one thing, and many people believe another. Two, the state of the perfect democracy, according to his point of view, does he consider that it is against democracy to effect this changeover by any means but peaceful means, or does he admit that the necessity of violent means is included in the definition of democracy? That's essential for our purpose.
Mr. Hathaway.
There are two questions here. First, the question of our attitude toward democracy itself. And I emphasize the fact that so far as we communists are concerned, we are ready to unite with all sincere advocates of democracy, recognizing that it's capitalist democracy here and now as against the fascist forces. Secondly, we believe that through the functioning of that democracy, the people will have an opportunity, when the majority are convinced of the correctness of socialism, to bring about the transformation from capitalism to socialism. And we emphasize here on this occasion that socialism can only come when the majority of the people desire it and are ready to institute it. And in that case, the change from capitalism to socialism would be brought about by peaceful democratic methods, unless a minority entrenched in power were to attempt to prevent the majority from carrying out its proposals.
Dr. Alexander.
This speech on democracy by Mr. Hathaway can't help but amuse me. It seems as if he's put Thomas Jefferson in Karl Marx's graveyard. I would like to ask him two things. One is, I believe he said that socialism cannot be brought about except or until the majority of the people desire it. Was socialism brought about in Russia by the desire of the majority, or by enforced upon the majority by a powerful minority? I would like to ask him if he will explain to me, a simple capitalist soul, the meaning of the word socialism as opposed to communism.
I have two questions, Mr. Hathaway.
Just as a means of opening, my good friend says that I'm attempting to bury Karl Marx in Tom Jefferson's grave. Well, I assure you that Tom Jefferson in his period played that role in determining the social progress of America that Karl Marx played in the development of the working class movement on a world scale. As for the question, first, in Russia, the majority of the Russian people responded to the proposals of the Bolshevik Party of the Communists for bread, peace, and land. And the overwhelming majority, following communist leadership, fighting for bread, for peace, and for land, overthrew Tsarism, established their own power, and as a majority, consciously moved onto the road of socialism. As for the question as to what I mean by socialism, by communism, and so forth, by socialism I mean this: the social ownership of the means of production in which the workers will receive compensation in accord with the work that they do. Under communism, already a more advanced form of socialism, the workers will receive according to their needs.
Mr. Levine.
Allow me to correct one possible interpretation which crept into Mr. Hathaway's statement and which I have encountered in the press in the last 2 or 3 years. The Bolsheviks did not overthrow Tsarism. Tsarism was overthrown by the Russian people. The Bolsheviks staged a counter-revolution in order to take over the people's government and disperse the duly and democratically elected constituent assembly for which they campaigned for several months once they got into power. But what I wanted to remark upon is this beautiful play of words which we encounter almost daily. Socialism, communism, capitalism. There is no such thing but capitalism. There is state capitalism, which passes under the name of either socialism or communism. There is private or finance capitalism. There is people's or mutualized capitalism. To play with the words of socialism or communism is to do exactly what Lenin did in 1917 when he went to the workers and to the peasants. And he said, the factories to the workers, they believed it. And he said to the peasants, the land to the peasants, they believed it. The factories went to a bureaucracy. The land went to a bureaucracy. The government bureaucracy has sold the world the fiction that they represent a form of social ownership, but they will not let the workers nor the peasants express themselves as to who are the rightful owners of the factories or of the land.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Hartley, Mr. Lerner, you've been awfully quiet over there. What have you got to say about all this?
I think we ought to give Mr. Hathaway a rest for a while. And I also think we ought to give Russian history a rest for a while and turn to America. I'd like to consider the question of majority rule and freedom of minorities with which we started our discussion. I think it would help us considerably if we attempted to take a historical view of this whole problem. And in doing that, I think we'll find that democracy, as we have known it, has occupied a relatively short span in the total history of the human race, that thus far democracy has operated on the upward arc of the economic circle, that democracy has operated within a capitalist structure which has been expanding and which has allowed for a fairly wide distribution of national income. In that period of economic expansion, it has been possible for the democratic machinery to function with relative effectiveness because there has not been the strain involved upon it which we have come recently to see in the period of deficit economies everywhere throughout the world. In that sense, democracy for the first time is really being tried. Democracy for the first time is really being tested. And as part of that test, we're attempting to find out in every country whether the machinery of majority rule can achieve a distribution of national income and an expansion of it, and whether the machinery of minority rights can achieve the insurance of civil liberties for people. I think it's worthwhile saying, first of all, that majority rule cannot possibly operate unless we start with a belief in the people involved in our democracy. Any notion such as was once expressed by a famous American statesman when he said, "Your people, sir, is a beast," any such notion is incompatible with an effective functioning of majority rule. Nevertheless, I think it's very necessary for us to remember that merely clinging to the machinery of minority rights is not going to solve our political problems. That is a negative insurance. It is not a positive and affirmative method. I think it's well for us to remember that we have to have, first of all, economic stability before minority rights can have any chance. And finally, we must remember that minority rights can easily become the rationalization that an economic group uses for minority rule.
Thank you, Mr. Lerner. Now, unfortunately, the clock is our master, and we must have time for questions. Just before the question period is over, I'm going to ask Mr. Demetriaga, who is an expert in this field, to do something that we seldom do on this platform, to sum up and see where we've gotten, what common denominators we've arrived at, if any, and then we'll let the other speakers here briefly check on whether he's right or wrong. Now for the questions. We'll take the man in the balcony there. Rise and state the name of the person to whom your question is directed, and make your questions brief, please. Question?
Mr. Hathaway.
Mr. Hathaway stated that the democracy he expects is the democracy that will permit this present capitalist class to bring in socialism peacefully. In view of the fact, Mr. Hathaway, that the Communist Party at various times has changed this program more often than anyone can imagine, and in view of the fact that the Communist Party today has become nothing more but a reform organization, don't you think that the working class, Mr. Hathaway, would do very well to drop any nonsense of any possibility of bettering its condition under this present system of society and listen to the message of the Socialist Labor Party, the only revolutionary organization in the United States?
All right. Well, comment on that, Mr. Hathaway, please.
Very briefly. First, I did not say that the capitalist class would bring in socialism through democracy. I said that the American people, under the leadership of the working class, would bring in socialism through democracy. As for the last point, the Socialist Labor Party, every once in a while, comes to life just long enough to make a speech as long as we heard tonight, and it's never heard from on other occasions, and never again.
Now, sir, we don't allow that. Will you ask that man to leave? All right. Question, please. Now, let's make it brief. I'm sorry, I'll have to cut you off unless we make it brief. Yes? Mr. Madermadiriaga.
Yes. You said democracy is that kind of government organization where the majority rule should prevail over the minority. Now, in view of that, do you support the Spanish Republic?
That is a question that Mr. Madermadiriaga has been protected from because of the peculiar family relationships that of his family ties in Spain. I'm not going to ask him to comment on the Spanish situation. I'm very sorry, but that becomes a personal question in his particular case. If it were not so, he would ask. All right.
May I point out that I consider that question thoroughly unfair and beneath the debate, that I did not come here to discuss the Spanish situation, that if and when I think it fit, I will, and that I am undergoing considerable pain on both sides because of my silence.
Would you please
tell us the essential difference between communism and fascism?
Who's that question,
Director? Mr. Hathaway.
Mr. Hathaway, the essential difference between communism and fascism.
Fascism is the dictatorship of the biggest, most powerful capitalist groups, the big monopolies, directed against the mass of the people. Communism, on the contrary, represents the rule of the overwhelming majority of the people, workers, farmers, professional people, and so forth, striving to create a new social system.
The last row in the balcony there, yes? That man, the other man, yes?
Pretend to defend democracy when they stand for the suppression of religion.
How can the communists pretend to stand for democracy when they suppress freedom of religion?
The Communist Party does not suppress religious freedom, but on the contrary, guarantees religious freedom to all people.
Mr. Levine, yes?
Is it possible for our democracy to bear the fruit it was originally intended for with all those communists eating at its vital organs and causing that digestion you referred to?
I'm sorry, that was not clear to us. It may have gone over the air, but I didn't get it down here at all. Will you repeat it, please? Will you repeat your question?
Is it possible for our democratic form of government to continue the good work it had done up until 1929 with all those communists eating at its vital organs and causing the depression or the
Yes, the gentleman thinks that the communists are eating at the vital organs of democracy. What do you think about that?
May I ask it?
Please.
I think it is a great handicap, indeed, on democracy to have to combat those forces which render lip service to it, but which seek at all times to stab it in the back. But I have so much faith in democracy to be able to overcome it by education and the power of reason that I verily believe that democracy in the future will look back upon these forces as mere episodes in a long struggle forward. I believe, therefore, that democracy can go forward in spite of the handicaps to which I subscribe with the person who asked the question.
The lady there, quietly.
I should like to ask Mr. Hathaway, by what powers of reasoning he arrives at the conclusion that the majority of people necessarily have better brain power than the minority.
All right, Mr. Hathaway.
Is it numbers or is it quality of brain power that counts?
Mr. Hathaway.
I have faith in the majority, not only numerically, but I believe that within the mass of the people, within the majority, there's that brain power that can solve the problems before the people and carry the people and society generally forward.
Question over there, yes? Man in front.
Mr. Hathaway.
Now, have I got another question? Mr. Hathaway's had loads of questions. Let's take this next man.
Mr. Hathaway, too.
Well, all right. Go ahead with yours. Yes?
Mr. Hathaway.
All right.
In the Daily Worker, and in Mr. Browder's new book, The People's Front, that type of movement is described as bringing about a greater democracy. Will you explain how this is so?
In urging the adoption of a People's Front policy, the communists simply mean this. We urge common action by communists, by socialists, by progressive Democrats, by progressive Republicans, by small business people, by middle class groups, by all of those people that believe in democracy, that are ready to defend democracy against fascism, that are ready to carry forward a fight for the solution of those immediate economic problems that today confront the mass of the people. We believe that through such a common front, such a people's front, such as exists today in Spain and in France and is developing here, that we can guarantee the existence of democracy and solve the people's problems.
I'll take a question for either Dr. Alexander or Mr. Lerner. Who has it? Dr. Alexander, yes?
Yes, doctor.
All right. Quiet, please. Quiet, yes?
Hey, Daniel, come to judgment. Dr. Alexander, don't you feel, for I'm perfectly willing, I agree with Mr. Lerner, to let Russia alone. I only wish to God they'd let us alone.
Question, please.
Don't you feel that radicalism, communism, if you will, having learned to pronounce the H in shibboleth and to develop the mock in democracy, has sneaked into both Republican and Democratic parties, intending and starting, well, first to subvert them and then to wreck this American Republic?
All right. All right.
I'm interested in America and the American Republic.
All right.
That's my ideal of democracy.
All right. Dr. Alexander, will you comment on his remark?
I believe what he's asking is if the communists are not boring from within, to use their own phrase, in both of our major political parties and in all of our minor parties, I think I should answer that very definitely yes. It's an internationalist movement.
Even in...
All right.
I might only add that you notice that we're boring in even to the town hall meetings.
All right. To Mr. Lerner, question for Mr. Lerner.
Yes,
Mr. Lerner, all right.
Don't you think that the old theory of states' rights, which arose under entirely different conditions of communication transportation than we have today, is today threatening American democracy through the development of, say, the Southern lynching system, Huey Long's dictatorship, fascist dictatorship in Louisiana, and the threatened dictatorship in a neighboring city?
Mr. Lerner, will you remark briefly on that? We're about to...
I believe that states' rights is a threat to America in only one sense, insofar as it should prevent the national government from dealing adequately with the pressing problems of economic control. I should say that the danger of a dictatorship in a neighboring city is due not to states' rights, sure, but to the concentrated economic power that the mayor of that city represents. Outside of that, I should say the states' rights has genuine value insofar as it represents administrative units and insofar as it represents cultural regionalism.
Thank you, Mr. Lerner. Now, Mr. Demetriaga, it's too bad that we have to obey the clock. This is one of those programs we could go on for 2 hours with. But will you attempt to summarize where you think we've gotten, what points of points we've agreed on, and what are our essential differences?
Mr. Chairman, I think we agree enough to make a community, and we disagree enough to make a democracy. We didn't expect to settle anything, and therefore we succeeded. I believe that we all agree that, although we haven't said it, but I think it's implied in all we said, that the kernel and soul of a democracy is respect for the individual. That's what I meant when I said that a good republic is a healthy community. No community is healthy if all its individuals are not healthy and well-situated. That, of course, depends very much on them. A community must have enough liberty for people, if necessary, to err
though not enough to err and destroy the community. We believe in majority rule, at any rate in practice, and some of us also in theory. We believe in minority protection, though here I don't know how far the protection to the minority extended by Mr. Hathaway might not be smothering. We believe in freedom of thought also, though possibly for some of us this would imply certain qualifications, not for me. And possibly we disagree on the relations of economic power with political power and how far these relations hamper the development of democracies or even the very existence of a democracy. We disagree perhaps in the practice of the rule of the majority, how the machinery is going to be organized for putting it into effect, how the leaders that it throws up are to be selected, what is going to be the degree of control of those leaders, how, as Dr. Ruth Alexander reminded us, intellect and ethics are going to be assured at the top. We possibly disagree as to when and where the role of violence might be necessary. And we possibly disagree, though we have not discussed, on how far a too early adoption of democracy at once as a means may or may not help in bringing about democracy as an end. I would wind up with one word about which I'm sure that not only all at this table, but all in the hall and all in the air may agree. If we were in doubt as to how to define a democracy, we would say a democracy is a place where a town meeting of the air can take place.
All right, Mr. Hathaway, do you take exception to any of those summations of Mr. Demetriaga's?
I would emphasize only a final point. Namely, the threat to democracy that today comes from the forces of fascism. And I would urge a unity of all advocates of democracy to maintain it.
Dr. Alexander.
I'd like to emphasize again the necessity for the separation of powers between economics and politics if democracy is to endure, and mean freedom, not the word, but the concept on which this country was founded.
Mr. Lerner.
I should agree with Dr. Demetriaga. I should emphasize first the need of the sense of the dignity and the potential ability of the individual as being central. Secondly, the role of economic power, more than he does, the role of economic power in endangering democracy, and the role of economic control in making its insurance and continuance possible. Finally, I should say the role of violence will come in not when the democracy gets control, but only when there is a fascist counterthrust.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. I'm terribly sorry there isn't time now. We've got to obey the clock. Thank you very much, Mr. Lerner. Now, before Mr. Claney goes on with next week's program, I have two important announcements to make. Reverend Russell Cartwright Straup of Lynchburg, Virginia, whose 500-word essay on Does Science Promote Human Happiness, won for him an appearance on this program, will be with us next week, Thursday, as a guest speaker representing the radio audience. And now we want to select another guest speaker to represent our radio audience. The writer of a 1,000-word essay on the topic of this evening, What Does Democracy Mean?, which in the opinion of our committee is judged the most constructive, will be invited to New York to be our guest here for several days and to appear as a speaker on a future town meeting broadcast. And if he's not a resident of Washington, D.C., he will also be sent there for a tour of the nation's capital with all expenses paid, a proper reward, we think, for this kind of essay. Your essay, preferably typewritten, be on one side of the page only, must be mailed to us not later than February 15th. Please be certain to give your name and address and mail your entry to the Town Hall, 123 West 43rd Street, New York City. Please remember the deadline. All essays must be postmarked not later than midnight, February 15th. And now, Mr. Claney.
Next week at this hour, the town meeting subject will be, should Congress adopt the President's armament proposals? Our speakers will be Congressman Edward V. Ezack of San Diego, California, and Congressman Maury Maverick of San Antonio, Texas. A complete account of tonight's broadcast, including the questions and answers, will be found in the Bulletin of America's Town Meeting of the Air, published by the Columbia University Press in cooperation with the Town Hall. This has been an NBC educational feature, and this is the National Broadcasting Company.